All right, so we go around and say names, and why don't we, like, we'll do this little inner row, and then we'll do the outer row, just to avoid confusion. Domio?
Domio.
Jim.
Mark.
Shinzon.
Bob.
Myoju.
Jinryu.
David.
Frankie.
Shoketsu. Rick. Michelle.
Suzanne.
Mary.
Mark.
Diane.
All right. Thank you all for coming. Let's see, in terms of announcements, as I think you may have seen in the newsletter, and many of you were there, we had a very successful fundraiser last weekend that raised more than we expected, and it was very fun. And thanks to all who supported it, but Frank, it was your idea.
It was?
I mean, you said, let's do an event.
She always says it was.
It was. She's like, I didn't do anything. But, you know, unless somebody makes it happen, doesn't happen. So thank you. Let's see. And then next Sunday is our face-off ceremony, the festival of the Buddha's birth. So it would also be a Dharma school Sunday. And so I'm hoping some kids will stay for the ceremony, and we're going to hand them the tissue paper petals to pass out while we're processing up and down, and we'll have a bower with the baby Buddha, and we pour sweet tea over the Buddha's head, and it's a very sweet ceremony. So that will be in place, like, at this time of day. And then we also have, some of you have already seen it, but a one-day retreat on Saturday, April 20th, from 8:30 to 5, and there's a little schedule on here, and there's been a link in the newsletter and stuff. If you know you're going to be there, it's helpful if you, I mean, it is a drop-in thing. If you do want to just come for a couple hours, you can do that. If you're going to be there over lunch, bring a vegetarian bag lunch with you. It's nice to know, just so we know that, you know, there's going to be people there. That's nice. And also we plan work assignments for the work period. And then also, I have on the schedule a Mondo practice, which is the formal question and answer, that starts at 3:30. So it's you can do a full day of retreat, and if you don't want to do Mondo, you just want a quiet day of retreat. So this was the compromise. I asked earlier, do people want to do Mondo or not? Now we have pretty much a full day of retreat, and then the Mondo's at the end, and if you want to stay for that, you can. If you don't, if you want to just leave, that's fine. But I don't want to bother to do the Mondo unless we have about 6 people who are committed to staying for that. So please let us know if you want to do that. I'll pass that around.
Also, Domio, next Saturday, we forgot to put it in the newsletter, but it's the poetry class at 10 o'clock. And we'll meet in the small room, in the children's room, so that the Dharma tea people don't get interrupted.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. So, and the last time we met, people just loved the experience of reading haiku and Japanese poetry and writing poetry. So, that's what to say. And from now on, I've given her the dates for the rest of the year.
Okay, and they'll be on the calendar now.
Yeah.
All right. And that will be in this week's newsletter as well, just to remind you. But that doesn't go out till Friday morning, so. Yeah, all right. Anything else anybody can think of? Oh, well, I'm giving a Dharma talk today on the meaning and value of lineage. And part of the reason that I'm talking about that is that on April 28th, which is a Sunday, we are, there's what we call the Dharma Cloud Lineage Day at Dharma Rain Zen Center. So there will still be stuff here, and actually if you are, you're not going to Dharma Rain, and you are available to help staff the Sunday thing here, please let me know, because once I kind of figure out, you know, who's going over there, then we have to staff what's happening here. So somebody might have an opportunity as well to bring in an article or a topic for discussion or something for this part of the day. But what we're going to be doing at Dharma Rain is in the morning, their practice starts at 8:30, and it's kind of similar to ours. They do the two periods of meditation, then they do their chanting service, and then there's a little break for tea and cookies. Then there's a talk, and we'll be all joining together in other sanghas in the Dharma Club lineage, including from Eugene, and from Sandy, and from Hood River, are going to be there as well. And we'll all join together in practice, and then the talk will be a panel discussion about lineage, including me, and Kakumyo, the abbot at Dharma Rain, and Sato, the teacher down in Eugene. Then there will be a community lunch that everyone is invited to, and that whole part of the day is open to anyone. Just, you know, go to Dharma Rain if you feel like it. Then after lunch, from about 1:30 to 3:30, we're having a more focused session where there's going to be as up to 10 kind of delegates for each sangha that are going to be, we haven't decided exactly what we're going to do yet, but it's going to be more of a getting to know each other as the different groups session, discussing some things that are important to us. So I think that'll be a sweet part of the day. But we're limiting the numbers just so that it's more intimate. So if you're interested in that, let me know. You're welcome to come to the morning part in any case. All right. So, lineage.
What's the big deal about lineage? So today in our chanting service, we recited a line of women Dharma ancestors. Now technically, that is not a lineage because that's not an unbroken line from, you know, teacher to student. There's a few teacher-student combos in there, but frankly, women have been deprived of having a lineage. And so it's very interesting when we do recite our actual lineage from Shakyamuni and all down through the Indian ancestors, Chinese ancestors, Japanese ancestors. It's very interesting that like it's men from Shakyamuni Buddha all the way down to Roshi Kennet. When Gyokuko dies, she will be on there. And then when I die, I will be in there. So like the last three names will be women. So yeah, we're taking it over. let's see. So I'm going to talk about the mythology of lineage. Then I'm going to talk about the reality of lineage. And I'll talk about a number of ways in which this is significant and important to us, but the point that I'm going to get around to is that, as the way I see it, lineage forms two functions. One is to preserve this path of practice that is, you know, time-tested. It's not perfect, but you know, it's pretty effective for many people, and kind of passing that down in a way that preserves what's essential. So there's the kind of the for the sake of the lineage. But I see this as like an intersection between the individual and the collective. So that function of lineage is about passing down this collective tradition. But a lineage is composed of individuals, and we each individually practice, and we each individually awaken. So it's kind of this where this intersection happens. So I see it's not just that the individual serves the collective by being part of this lineage, by passing down this collective tradition, but I also see the individual aligning themselves with the collective tradition has many benefits. So the collective serves the individual as well, if you will. It's a important intersection. So hopefully that'll become more clear. So first of all, just the mythology of transmission and lineage. And if you're at all interested in this, this is an interesting book, Seeing Through Zen by John McCrae. He's a historian and a scholar, and I wouldn't say he tears apart the mythology of our lineage, but he points out in some ways, this is mythology, and actually our kind of our story about lineage was actually had a lot of polemical roots in China. But I'll start with the mythology. So the mythology goes that from Shakyamuni Buddha 2,500 years ago, the essence of this practice has been passed down person to person. Now in China, this became known as like the transmission outside the scriptures. So it's not about knowing a certain number of things. It's not about not about externals. It's some, you know, recognizing awakening in each other, and how, you know, what is that? How do you do that? And so it's the idea is that a Buddha recognizes Buddha. An awakened being can recognize you've seen what I've seen. Like kind of a there's just a kind of mysterious, mystical, ineffable recognition resonance. So the idea is then Shakyamuni, you know, Maka Kasho was his first Dharma heir. And there's the story of how Ananda, who had amazing memory and had all of the Buddha's teachings in his head, was Buddha's attendant, somehow still didn't get it. And he had to become a student of Maka Kasho for quite a number of years before, you know, he got this essential matter, which nobody can really describe. So this is the mythology, right? So then Maka Kasho does pass it down to Ananda, and you know, goes down through the generations. It has to be a face-to-face meeting, a real personal relationship. There were different aspects of lineage, monks in ordination lineages in China. Because we really started to emphasize this in China, because the Chinese are very focused on familial ties and filial piety and lineage and all that kind of stuff in like biological terms. So in monks in China, when they got ordained, they essentially joined a ordination family. They joined a new family. and then there came the this concept of Chan, this Dharma transmission, this ineffable thing that was passed on. And this process keeps going through China. Dogen, who was our first Soto Zen ancestor in Japan, he had Buddhist teachers in Japan, but then he went to China and studied with Ru Jing, a Soto Zen teacher, and he considered Ru Jing his, like that he was in Ru Jing's Dharma lineage, if you will, because they had this, you know, meeting of minds. He received this transmission from Ru Jing. So then he passes it down. Several generations later, Keizan is another significant Soto Zen ancestor, and he built something that's still there today, the Goroho, or the five Masters Peak at his monastery. And in it, he enshrined Ru Jing's sayings, a bone from Dogen, a sutra that Dogen's student Ejo copied with his own blood, Ejo's student Gikai, his bones, and then Keizan's remains were also put there. So they're like, and then he specified that this kind of mausoleum should be revered by all subsequent Soto Zen temples and practitioners and stuff like that. So that kind of established this is, you know, through these five guys, this is where our lineage, the Soto Zen lineage, comes. So, you know, the exact process and meaning of Dharma transmission has changed over the centuries, but we still do it. So Kato Chisan was a Japanese priest. He was abbot at a big monastery. He met Roshi Kennett, this English woman, when he was traveling, and he kind of saw something in her and invited her to come and study with him, which was just not done. I mean, to invite a Westerner into a Japanese monastery and to invite a woman Westerner into a Japanese, I mean, this is just... But he had enough stature, he could kind of get away with it. And she did not have an easy time. But she studied with him, she received Dharma transmission from him, then she moved. She really couldn't get out of Japan fast enough. It wasn't that fun of experience. She moved to California and established Shasta Abbey. She had many students, two of which were Kyogen and Gyokoko, who showed up, you know, in their early 20s, in the 70s, and practiced there, eventually also receiving Dharma transmission from her. They came up to Portland, and there was a Portland Buddhist priory that they helped, you know, Shasta Abbey offshoot, that they helped lead. Then at a certain point, stuff happened. They broke with the abbey and established kind of their own independent, so the Portland Buddhist Priory still exists, but they founded Dharma Rain Zen Center. So then I studied with them, Shintai studied with them. I practiced closely with Gyokoko for 15 years. I became her student and formal student in 96. And I was ordained in 2001. And then I received Dharma transmission in 2010. So transmission is not guaranteed. It's not like I get ordained, I study, I put in my time, I pass a test. All right. It's really more of an apprenticeship process. You know, and it's very Asian in tone. I mean, I think we have apprenticeship in the West as well, but if you ever watch any Japanese shows, I mean, the way that we do Zen is the way they do furniture building, they do calligraphy, they do martial arts, they do, you know, any discipline or art, this is the way they do it. You come, typically, I don't even explain anything to you. You just hang around and watch me for years. And then you get to start doing stuff and you get to make lots of mistakes. And then after, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, you've absorbed it enough and you can do it. You're a master of your own. So it's a very organic, you know, and the masters decides when you're ready. And what is that? It's tough. I mean, when you think about it, we all, you know, those of us who've done this process submit to this as adults. You know, we're not kids. We're not, and yet we're still kind of submitting to this other person's, you know, trying to like, I'm going to try to learn your thing and you're going to tell me when I'm ready. So it can be a challenging situation. So, but finally, Gyokoko did entrust me with the Dharma in 2010. I can't remember exactly when. It was around that time, very close to that time, maybe 2011, when Shintai received Dharma transmission as well. And in that ceremony, which is private, so the Sangha ends up seeing the results of it, but not the ceremony itself. In that transmission ceremony, we agree to pass this on. That is part of what we're agreeing to do, is to pass on this tradition. So, you know, it's kind of a special, precious thing. The reality, you know, apart from the myth, the reality, this whole list that we recite from Shakyamuni down to the present has some gaps. It's not entirely true. It's amazing how much of it is true. But they have proven, you know, there's certain like, well, that guy died before, you know, that guy even started, you know, practicing. So there's some mythology in there. And then, as I mentioned, this evolution in China, there was certainly respect for teachers in India, but this tracing your lineage and this emphasis on it became more formalized in China. One of the things that it did, in the interest of full disclosure, it legitimized Chinese Buddhism. So the Chinese were kind of uncomfortable about looking back to India for this tradition. Whereas if you think about this mythology anyway of Dharma transmission, where, you know, a teacher recognizes in the student exactly, you know, you have received the essence. So then every ancestor has the essence, the same essence that Shakyamuni Buddha did. So you don't have to look back to Shakyamuni Buddha or Indian ancestors. They're not the experts. You have this lineage. So it can be a wholly, you know, Chinese legit thing. So that was one function of it. Another was that Chan ended up being one of the, if not the most dominant form of Buddhism in China. And part of it was being able to point to this legitimizing lineage chart. So other forms of Buddhism started to evolve their own as well. And that was in a culture where family lines and filial piety were very important. It also gave clerical and governmental control over the religion and the monastic sangha, because they started to be able to regulate how this Dharma transmission process proceeded. Who could perform Dharma transmission? After a while, it became you had to be an abbot of a public monastery in order to actually officially transmit your Dharma. So only those lineages survived that went through abbacies of public monasteries, which were given out by those in power in particular ways. So I don't know. Sometimes it can be a little discouraging looking at history. You know, it starts kind of eating away at your myths. But it was, I think it's interesting that even though McCrae points out a lot of that aspect of lineage, he has a couple of principles. He says, McCrae's rules of Zen studies. So he says, lineage assertions are as wrong as they are strong. So kind of the more specific and elaborate the story, the more likely it's kind of just a myth. But then he says, it's not true, and therefore it's more important. So this is kind of, you know, the James Campbell or Joseph Campbell's, like, you know, idea of myth. In a way, it's the stories we tell about all of this that's more significant than maybe how exactly it happened. So he said, the contents of Zen texts should not be evaluated using a simple-minded criterion of journalistic accuracy. That is, did it really happen? For any event or saying to have occurred would be a trivial reality involving a mere handful of people at one imagined point in time, which would be overwhelmed by the thousands of people over the centuries who were involved in the creation of Zen legends. The mythopoeic creation of Zen literature implies the religious imagination of the Chinese people, a phenomenon of vast scale and deep significance. So, you know, what is really going on in terms of lineage? What is transmitted, and why is it valuable to think of our tradition in these terms? So first, there's a couple things that aren't so important. So this is part of it. I was thinking about this panel discussion presentation I'm going to do on the 28th. Lineage. Okay, what is the importance of lineage? Lineage, all right. You know, how is our lineage different from Suzuki Roshi lineage or Great Bao lineage? Or, you know, I started thinking about those differences. But then I was starting to think, like, it's not really all that important. So, first of all, one of the things that isn't that important in terms of this lineage thing, I don't think it's all that important that we pin down the meaning of enlightenment and exactly what somebody recognized in somebody else. I mean, I think it's legit to question, you know, what is awakening and what is it that we're recognizing in each other, but I think we could get really fixated on that and miss the larger value of this. I mean, I think it's important that somebody who gets transmitted, and this is actually something that when you receive Dharma transmission, it's still not all that clear. What was it? You may think, and it actually, it's a delusion that is invited. It's like, I got it now. Somebody transmitted the Dharma to me. I got it figured out. You know, it's just, it's not really, it's kind of disappointing, frankly, because, you know, I mean, it's kind of dream. Like, at some point, I'll just know. And from then on out, it'll be smooth sailing. You know, not so much. So you have a deep enough personal realization. I mean, you should have some insight into foundational Buddhist teachings, emptiness, Buddha nature. So that's one of the things in Zen, you know, you should have some sense of emptiness, suchness, Buddha nature. But also, not just that realization, but also a willingness and a capability to steep yourself in the tradition and pass the essence of it on to others faithfully. So you may attain, you know, great peace of mind and realization and integration and whatever in through your Zen practice, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you should receive Dharma transmission, unless you're really interested in teaching and sharing it and supporting this collective tradition. And a capability. I mean, sometimes some of us are not just, we're not able to do that. We have other responsibilities or other skills or whatever. Okay, so the second thing that I don't think is that important about it is these differences between lineages. And I thought about this is like, if somebody asked you to define what's the value of family, and then you said, well, you know, we always have cranberry sauce at Thanksgiving. You know, I mean, it's like there's these little things that, yeah, you typically your family might do other than, you know, other families, but that's not what family is about. That's not the essence of family. It's a marker, can, you know, be a marker of a different group. It's not all that important. Still, if you're curious, there are some things that do characterize our lineage. We focus on Zazen, on Shikantaza. I mean, most Soto Zen lineages do. We are a fierce champion of lay practice. We really shy away from any kind of suggestion that something can be achieved through monastic practice that can't be achieved through lay practice. So that is because the Carlsons, actually, at Shasta Abbey, there was a lot of emphasis on monastic practice. The lay people were just kind of, they practiced, but it was understood that it was kind of compromised. And Kyogen and Gyoko came up here to establish Dharmarain, still called a Soto Zen temple for lay practice. So they did end up having monks, but that was their whole purpose.
Wait, Tomio, yeah. So they broke from that tradition then? They broke from Jiu Kemet's tradition. How then would you call yourself part of the lineage when you make such a big shift?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Dharmarain actually has a document put together by a bunch of seniors at the temple, kind of characterizing their lineage in this way. And it gives a lot of acknowledgement to Roshi Kennett and all the things that they carried down from her, including the liturgical calendar and I mean, and she definitely worked with lay people, so it's not like it was a complete break. So there is this, you know, each generation, each teacher is free to change things up a little bit, respond more appropriately in the way they see it to the people that they're dealing with. So that's part of what makes our tradition you know, responsive and lively. But then there's this, well, how, you know, how much change can happen before now you're not really honoring that? So it's a, this is again, this is a kind of that kind of apprenticeship model where you can't, you couldn't necessarily put it down on paper how much of a break is too much of a break. But you kind of feel it and know it and see it. So, you know, the Carlsons were so steeped in Roshi Kennett's tradition that I think, you know, her imprint is still very much on our lineage, even though they championed lay practice, which is really the only change that they made.
So what I'm hearing then is that the Cloud lineage really started with the Carlsons.
Well, so we define, it's kind of a new creation, because like Maizumi Roshi has, you know, the White Plum lineage comes from Maizumi Roshi, and the Branching Streams lineage comes from Suzuki, because there's this kind of break between Japan and America. I mean, you know, it continues, but you've got to kind of define yourself differently. So we define it as Roshi Kennett coming through Roshi Kennett and then the Carlsons, either both of the Carlsons, Kyogen and Gyoko, who were married. And then coming out of that, whatever comes out of that. So, yeah. What was your question again?
That was it.
Okay. So we are a fierce champion of lay practice, but part of the typical thing, ordination requires prolonged residential practice, renunciation, and service. So there are many lineages where if you're a serious lay practitioner, you get ordained, which to my mind is ridiculous, but you know, there are places where that is so. And so that certainly the people like Shintai, you know, somebody who's actually been Dharma transmitted, you know, in another lineage she would be ordained, whereas in our lineage we really see it as, you know, these are two, and I think in a way we're able to do that because we see these as equal paths. Because both are equal, we can differentiate them. We can, you know, say, well, this is one way to do it.
So Shintai had to stay in the monastery too?
No.
But you said that was part of it?
She is, in another lineage, she might be ordained. In this lineage, she's not, because she didn't do that extended residential practice, which I did. Which I did, like, 7 years of living in this community and having no life of my own.
So what is the difference between what she does and can do versus what you do and can do?
It is kind of an open question, because there's not much. In many lineages, lay people, even entrusted lay people, can't give precepts. But in our lineage, they can, because in a way, well, what's the point of being Dharma transmit if you can't transmit anything, you know, if you can't give the precepts? So she can take formal students. I guess the only thing that she couldn't do is ordain somebody, because she didn't do that practice. So you know, I could ordain somebody, I can pass on that practice and oversee that kind of training, but otherwise, not too much.
So you were ordained before you had the Dharma transmission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got ordained in 2001 and then 2000. And we do the Dharma transmission process is a little bit different. Although I don't know that I'm, it seems we're improvising. I don't know. But the Carlsons, there's three transmission silks that we copy by hand and they kind of prove our Dharma transmission, and they're signed by our teacher and stuff. And the way that the Carlsons did it is the lay teachers received this one that has to do with the precepts. And that was called Denkai. And they separated the Dharma transmission into two pieces. And So I received Denkai, and then a couple years later, I received Denbo, which has these other two silks. So they did not give the other two silks to the lay people as some way to kind of differentiate. I don't know. There's part of me just like, they either got it or they don't. I don't know. Why would I not, why would I not transmit some of this to them? I don't know. So it's a kind of an open controversy in a way. It's exactly how to, and that's why Shintai is part of a Lay Zen Teachers Association, where, you know, they're providing support for each other because this is kind of a new phenomenon. This did not happen. I mean, there's been lay masters in Buddhism since the beginning, but this kind of the number and proliferation and the important role that they're having in Dharma in the West is new. So they're having to get together and and kind of help support each other and decide what this means. And it's kind of sensitive, because like I go to the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference, which is just for priests, which I think is kind of arrogant for us to say we are the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, and lay teachers can't be part of it. We should be the Soto Zen Priests Association, not just like we are Soto Zen. So there's some discussion. I'm going to be part of the committee talking about how we might involve lay teachers in the SCBA. So anyway. Another important part of our lineage is that, and I feel like this is something that this is a little more Carlson oriented than the Abbey, but they named their place Dharma Rain from an image in the Lotus Sutra where the Dharma rain falls on the forest, and there's big trees and there's bushes and there's plants, and everything takes up just the water that it needs, takes just what it needs. So their approach has been to offer all kinds of, you know, offer retreat, offer formal studentship, offer classes, offer sittings, offer potlucks, whatever, and people take what they need. So there's not a sense like, this is the, if you were really signed up to this program, you'd be doing this, which, you know, in some Zen centers, you might encounter, like, if you were really part of the group, you would, you know, go to session and you would do all this stuff and you would, you know, there'd be kind of a program that you'd sign up for. So it's very open-handed. We also admit the reality of Kensho, kind of dramatic awakening experiences, but without emphasizing them. We're not seeking them. We're not going for them. We don't make a huge deal out of them, but we also don't deny that they happen to some people. And that awakening, whether it's a dramatic thing or a gradual thing, is something that we are looking for. What you wake up to in Kensho is something we are looking for, but it doesn't have to be a dramatic awakening experience. And then we also have the emphasis on the importance of Sangha, not just in terms of support, but in terms of teaching. So in the sense that there's a vertical sense of teaching, like here's somebody who's further along in practice than you and they more knowledgeable and they can, you know, advise you. That's one aspect. But then we teach each other kind of whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. So this is where as Sangha gets more structure, as there's more practice roles, like Shoketsu just did Shuso, and you know, there's people who are taking on more responsibility, then everybody is going to end up being, you know, in a superior position or a junior position or a, you know, and this, as there's more interactions, we are taught by each other through feedback, through, sometimes it's called like a rock tumbler, like we're just being, you know, gone like this, and the rocks just kind of go like this until they just kind of get smoother. So it's not necessarily a pleasant process throughout, but that's part of our lineage tradition as well, is to really recognize that that's an important aspect of our practice. So, anyway, I mean, I guess I could have just done the whole Dharma talk about that. But just briefly, in terms of this, you know, this kind of, I think a lineage is a vital place of intersection between the individual and the collective. Because I think we, a lot of times, it's pretty obvious, okay, the individuals are, you know, we embrace this model and or we strive to become part of the lineage in order to pass down this collective tradition. It's interesting to know that from the beginning, Buddhism has recognized what's called a Pratyeka Buddha, somebody who awakens all on their own. So you don't have to be part of this collective tradition. This isn't the only way. People sometimes just awaken in their own individual way. And we've met these people, right? They're just, there's enlightened people all over. But a Pratyeka Buddha can't teach their way to someone else. They have they're a unique person. They did their unique thing. They, you know, went mountain climbing and, you know, had great insight on the top of a mountain. And, you know, you're going to go climb a mountain now? I mean, it's so the Pratyeka Buddha is contrasted with a Buddha or a teaching Buddha who has a path that they can teach to others. So when we are becoming part of a lineage, we're taking part in this path and we're helping to pass this on. So, I mean, I may have individual expressions and insights and experiences that are valuable, but what's most important is that I am grounded in the tradition and I can teach you the path. You know, not... Again, it's kind of an apprenticeship thing. There's some improvisation, whatever. But it has to be true enough to the path that I'm really passing along this communally held and time-tested thing. So we all share and benefit from a path. Most of us are not Pratyeka Buddhas. We need the support of the Sangha and the teachings and the practices and to tap into this. Now, so this is as a collectively held tradition, the aspect of lineage. As a Sangha, we create, invest in, maintain, and share something together. So that's another aspect of something that, you know, the individual supporting the collective lineage helps that to survive and pass through time. And as individuals, we have a choice to avail ourselves of what's on offer in a Sangha, and that's fine. We don't necessarily have to like dedicate ourselves to helping to maintain the collective tradition. But maybe we want to. Maybe we want to, you know, give back. Maybe that's part of our bodhisattva vow, is to see that this path is available to others, to see that it survives over time. So, and I feel like it's kind of a natural response of many people who, the more they get involved, the more responsible they feel for the Sangha and for this tradition and want to support its survival beyond just, you know, how it feeds you. But so in terms of how aligning yourself with the lineage can be helpful to your practice, not just helpful to the collective tradition surviving, it's a little bit like the rock tumbler. It's not necessarily a comfortable process, but I think it's a valuable one. So these are some of the benefits I was thinking of. Inevitably, we have to let go of preferences. We have to compromise and adapt. in order to align ourselves with the lineage, we have to tone down some of our individuality. We have to give up either our tendency to hide, if we have that, or a tendency to need to stick out and be the center of attention, if that's our tendency. We're inevitably changed and influenced by being part of this. This may seem like a weird way to put it, but I feel like sometimes we're allowing ourselves to be brainwashed, maybe in kind of a positive sense. I mean, in a, like, you've made a choice, this looks like a good deal, you're gonna be part of it, and then, you know, I mean, it kind of starts to affect you at ways that you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily aware of. And it's kind of wash, I think it was like washing the brain of its of its negativity and issues, perhaps. But and we learn and respect the party line, even if we have our own opinions and approaches. So, you know, we learn what the tradition says, what, you know, my teacher says, what, whatever. Even if you go like, I don't know about that. But you still know it. You still can be grounded in it and respect it. And this is an option for practitioners, but it's not an option for anyone who is going to carry on the lineage in a formal way to receive Dharma transmission and be a teacher, if you will. And I emphasize this mostly because I want to explain why we do focus on lineage as often as we do, particularly like if I heard some teacher move to Portland, Soto Zen teacher, and started a group, I would ask what lineage they were from. That would be the first question, is where did they come from? And this is why. In that process of aligning ourselves with the lineage, I feel like it trains the individual to be humble and responsible. It trains the individual to prioritize the best interests of the collective over their own desires. It keeps the individual accountable to the community. And then, as I was saying, it grounds their teaching in a time-tested tradition. We have to be able to express ourselves in our own way and respond spontaneously to the people we're encountering. But being grounded in a tradition mitigates that improvisation and interpretation. I mean, there's always going to be a dynamic tension there. But if you really never spent time in training, if you never immersed yourself in what the tradition is, you can, you know, go some weird places, frankly. So if I see, you know, well, somebody spent 6 months at a monastery and now they've set themselves up as a teacher and didn't receive any kind of authorization from anyone, I'll be like, I mean, they may be a brilliant, very neat, compassionate person, but I'm not going to trust that they can pass on this tradition. So just to close, you know, personally, I felt like at some point in, you know, and I said, like, everybody can decide how much of this they want to engage, but except if you get ordained, then you it's not an option. So at some point in my training, I mean, I struggled a lot with the training and I struggled a lot with my teacher. You know, that whole toning down the individuality and learning how to adapt and compromise, and that does not come easily to me. I had a sense that I was being made over into like this generic poster child of a monk, that I was being kind of squashed and molded and changed, and not to become Domio, but to become, you know, what the Sangha needed. What Buddhism said I should be, or something like that. It was like I was kind of giving up some of my uniqueness or individuality. you know, and I kind of, and recognizing that, I don't know, I guess there was a willingness to be transformed, a willingness to be changed into what would serve better. I mean, the ironic thing is, of course, like, they use the analogy of, like, we're a fish bag. We've had a bunch of fish, and even if you take all the fish out, you still stink. So it's kind of like, we don't really get our individuality washed out that much, you know, but it's all kind of relative. So I didn't leave too much time, but questions and discussions.
And this is, this is a controversial question, this thing, but
yeah.
So I personally had encounters with transmitted teachers who then the teacher thinks they made a mistake, right? You know, right? And then Roshi Baker and people like that. So I guess they saw the something in them, but then these people still screwed up. So they're not perfect Buddhas, like,
is right?
Okay.
I mean, that was part of the Chinese mythology, like, oh, and every one of these is like a complete, you know, they have the same awakening as the Buddha.
Yeah.
I see this as a very fallible system, but it's the only one we've got.
So then how do you blindly then, like, what if I was just so blind and I believed everything this teacher said and I abdicated my own thing, you know, because it's that joke back to the niche, you know? Like,
I don't know, I guess that's why we can't. It's just always a dynamic tension. It's always a middle way. We can't completely give up our discriminative thinking and like, whoa, this doesn't seem good. And yet we have to take a leap of faith. So I think it's like it's more like two steps in walking. Okay, for this 30 minutes, I'm going to take a leap of faith and just settle into Zazen. You know, then my discriminating mind comes back. I don't know. We have to learn to balance it. If we see we're actually, I just did the podcast on the hindrance of skeptical doubt, spiritual doubt, doubt about your path. You know, and if it's keeping you from moving forward, then you got to take a leap of faith. But on the other hand, it's blind faith is not the way either.
So, if you could very briefly tell me the top three things about our tradition, I think one of them would be support for and respect for lay discipleship.
I would say lay practice, because lay discipleship is an option, but it's just part of the menu. It's not required.
So what would another one or two be of our tradition?
Like you said, you offer whatever you can, and people take what they can. They don't have, there's no rigor.
And I think it's a, you know, so the depth is, I think that would be another one, the Dharma Rain approach, because the depth is available.
Mm-hmm.
We offer session, we offer lay discipleship, we offer study, we offer, you know, theoretically ordination. So it's there if people want to go down that road, but we really refrain from saying like, well, that's the real road. And that's part of, I feel, you know, the children's program is another way that we are sharing the Dharma with children. There's kind of no, we don't have any agenda when we're sharing the Dharma. You know, if somebody's asking for it, if somebody's appreciating it, you know, we rein it down and they go with it. Because you might say, like, I don't know, I mean, well, how many of these kids become Buddhist? Yeah, not very many. But are we sharing the, you know, we've rained some Dharma on them. We've affected them in some way. There's been some positive benefit. And then a third one?
If you have
Zazen.
Emphasis on Zazen. Chikan Zazen.
Yeah, but I mean, that doesn't particularly distinguish us from other Soto Zen groups, if you're looking for ones that are somewhat unique.
What about the British stuff, like all the Vespers and stuff that you do? Like, you know, only Tamarain does that.
That's a little bit like, you know, having cranberry sauce at Thanksgiving.
So
it's kind of fun, you know, it's kind of a fun difference, but yeah, it's not essential, I think.
Then what is the purpose to the individual? What is the purpose and why is it important to the individual of cloud lineage day?
Oh, that's a very good question. I guess it's, I see going to that would be along the lines of the individual aligning themselves with the collective. So what it will do is give people a sense of the collective beyond just right here, beyond just our group, beyond just me, beyond just Shintai. And you recognize you're part of something even bigger. And I don't know, I've always found that to be, for all of these reasons, I mean, it's inspiring in a way. It's also, at all these levels, it can be challenging. I think for me, it was kind of mostly inspiring because, like, when I went to Japan and I saw, you know, these, which their practice seemed very different. But then when I saw things that they were doing that we do, I was like, oh, Kyokuni didn't make this up. This is like, wow, this is really, you know, come down through the generations. So
I'm just struck by how when I met you, like in 2009, you were teaching us in a small group, that you had received Dharma transmission. I mean, you were a great dean priest, but
yeah,
I know, but it's just interesting. You were already out there.
Yeah.
Spreading the Dharma, sort
of. Yeah. There's a, you know, and there's a process. Dharma Rain is actually thinking of formalizing it a little bit as well, but that's something that Great Vow and Zen Community of Oregon have started to do. They'll at five, when somebody's been doing really intensive practice, either they've been at the monastery for 5 years or they've been a lay person and just, you know, done a lot of session and that kind of stuff, then they become a Dharma holder. Yes. And so they're not transmitted. They're not like, you know, go out and spread the Dharma as you will, but there's some acknowledgement there that they have been steeped in the tradition and they could, you know, lead a practice group. They could, you know, teach meditation. They could do these kinds of things.
So you brought up Great Vow.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about, lineage-wise or not, the relationship between Dharma Rain, Great Vow, and Dharma Rain and all their organization.
Well, we're really just totally separate. We're both Soto Zen. So Maizumi Roshi was a Soto Zen teacher in L.A. And, you know, so they came from Maizumi. We came from Roshi Kennett. The Carlsons and the Bays collaborated a lot, and so there's this mutual influence, which, you know, I really feel like because I've spent so much time out at Great Vow and with the Bays, like I am heavily influenced by them, which is why we recite their names as, you know, living Dharma teachers that have influenced our lineage. So there's this beautiful, you know, kind of mutual influence. I structured our morning, like if you go to the Dharma Cloud Day and you see how Dharma Rain does their morning chant, there'll be some familiarity. But I kind of did it because I thought maybe I should be really, really true to the lineage in this particular formal way. But I actually talked to Edjo McMullen, who trained in Japan, and he was just kind of like, each temple kind of does it the way they want to do it. So it's like, this is one area where I was invited to improvise. So our, the way we chant is really a kludge between Dharma Rain and Great Vow. So we added the karma verse at the beginning and the the three treasures verse standing. You know, Dharmarain doesn't do that. So that's kind of like a fun little kludge of the two. But when I go out to Great Vow, as much as I love to be there, you know, there's a little bit of a sense of being in somebody else's house. As opposed to, now I haven't done session with Dharmarain for ages because they don't go out of town and do session anymore, and I really like to do that. But when we did our own session, when Shintai and I and the Sangha, we created and we designed, we structured that the way our family does it. And then when we were sitting during that session, we were like, oh yeah, this is how session feels. Like it had that family feeling to it, which was very, very sweet. We hadn't, in a way, we hadn't realized how much we missed it until there we were doing things our way.
So you, I was just gonna chime in also, they shared space. Dharmarain and Zen Community of Oregon shared space at Portland Dharma Center for 10 years, 15 years. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of cross-pollination that happened there.
Was that the place on Hawthorne?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So you mentioned that the Dharma Cloud lineage comes from Jiu Kennet, and I know that Shasta Abbey is very much a traditional monastery. I know that Myo and Ford studied with Jiu Kennet, but do we have a pile of cousins out there somewhere, or are they mostly localized in Shasta Abbey?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, James Ford has been fairly prolific, or whatever you want to, how do you say it, when you have lots of offspring. but he also studied with koan tradition, which I feel like he's much more influenced by the koan, that koan tradition than he is. And he didn't spend very long at Shasta. So he basically got it. And early on, Roshi Kennet was transmitting people pretty quickly. Like, even the Carlsons kind of admit, all right, that was a little fast. So there's some people out there that got Dharma transmission that weren't steeped as long as, you know, later on we would like have liked to. So I don't feel a lot of similarity, you know. So that's like you can have a cousin that you don't feel you have much in common with. So that's kind of how I feel about James Ford's lineage. But it's tricky because the Shasta people have been fairly insular. They're very focused on the monastery. So even the priories are kind of like they're all looking toward the mothership. You know, like it's very strong emphasis, go visit the mothership, go to session at the mothership, like, which, so there's not so much like they, you know, I don't think the Portland Buddhist Priory comes to the Buddhist, you know, picnic in the park thing that we do. So I haven't gotten to know many of our cousins, but I that may be changing. They may be opening up a little bit. Maybe like New Year's Eve things or
yeah,
something like that.
There was yeah. A couple of things. I had a conversation with them where I kind of invited them to New Year's, and they were like, we do our own thing. And it was just like, oh, yeah. Okay, we'll, that's fine. And then it shifted when Uncutted passed that somehow.
Well, now you've got generations of people who don't know anything about that whole era. So they're like, whatever. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll let you all go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.